From the campus of the State University of Iowa, we bring you Wendell Johnson, professor of speech pathology and psychology, with a lecture in the classroom series General Semantics. Here is Professor Johnson.
I'm talking about the process of abstracting. And we're talking about this in terms of a diagram, which I have on the board. At the end of the last hour, I got far enough to talk, to mention that this is a process which we can think of as being organized in two ways, one by levels and the other by order, the relation among the levels, the relationship among the levels. At the end of the last hour, I started by talking about the level which is more obvious to us, I suppose, the naked eye level of observation, of abstracting, by means of the naked eye, the naked ear, the naked taste bud, and so forth. The world, as we are able to be aware of it, to abstract it, by means of the sensory receptors. So that when we talk about an apple or a piece of pie, a piece of chalk, anything at all, or a person, on this level, we are talking about that which we can directly observe, or which we do directly observe. We don't always observe all that we can. And so we would talk most accurately about that which we do observe. And in talking about it, if we are descriptive, if we talk about it on what we can call the first order level, verbal abstracting, we will say those things about what we observe which make it very individualistic, which make it different from everything else. Description deals with differences. As a sort of a rough rule of thumb, description deals with differences, and generalization or inference deals with similarities. So that if you're going to talk descriptively, you will say those things which will enable anyone else to tell what you are talking about from anything else with which it might be confused. Now, we'll be coming back to this, but I want to say enough now to indicate a little more about the nature of what we might call first-order verbal abstracting or descriptive kind of language. Included in what one is able to say or does say on the descriptive first-order level about an apple or a person is the date and the place. These are differentiating characteristics. Man, this man. Also, there's always, which I suppose we should add now, there's always something like the word this or the equivalent. This or that or those, indicating specific examples, specific individuals. Not men, but this man. Or we name him John or Joe or Jim. But we also refer to him as of a time and place on a given date. Doing this habitually or quite often or adequately, shall we say, tends to make one highly aware of the fact that anything we may talk about is in a constant state of change. So that you don't talk about John Doe as though John Doe were the same today and tomorrow and yesterday and always will be the same. You talk about John Doe, if you are careful, if you are conscious of abstracting, with adequate reference to the time, the place, the circumstances, and also being careful to indicate which John Doe you mean in terms of those kinds of characteristics which are perceivable to what the legal profession would call a reasonably normal person. One talks carefully this way, for instance, about oneself, so that you don't talk about yourself as though you had some general characteristic. I have an inferiority complex, or I am inferior. I am inferior? This makes no sense on this level, you see. This is too vague to serve as a guide to what this statement is about. This is on a very high level of abstraction, generalization. I want to labor this a little bit because we very seldom in our ordinary daily talking or writing talk on this level or write on this level. We seldom are enumerative in a very detailed way, descriptive. We tend to float more or less up 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 levels, and I want to say something about that in the footnote. This is an organizing scheme. This is not a thermometer we're talking about. Well, you can't actually read these levels. You can't say that the statement which I just now made is on the 4th level or the 10th level, or this isn't the kind of an organizing scheme this is. You can talk about higher or lower. You can be conscious. You can get, in fact, quite skillful at detecting when the speaker is going to higher and to lower levels of abstraction. When he is including more details, when he is speaking so that you can tell more clearly the difference between what he is talking about and all other things with which you might confuse it, and when he is going to higher levels so that you can't tell what he is talking about from a great many other things that he might be talking about. You can become highly sensitive to this sort of thing. But I know of no way to reduce this to the kind of a thing that would be comparable to a thermometer reading. When I put on the board these words, by which I mean to designate the levels of abstracting, such as first order verbal level, second order verbal level, and so on, these are simply schematic. These do not refer to anything like degrees of Fahrenheit. So now, we usually then tend to float up, as we come to sense it, a fairly high level of abstraction in most of the talking we do. I had a teacher one time who had a name for this. He called it, that is most of what we say, the level of abstraction on which we operate usually. He called it conversation. And he wasn't just referring to people talking together over cups of coffee. He meant that most of the talking we do is comparable to that which we do in conversation. We don't exercise much more care in most of our talking than we do in ordinary conversation. And so we don't tend to speak with a high degree of descriptive clarity, usually. I think it is a wonderful exercise to try to do this. Try for a time to talk about the person sitting next to you, to think about it, as so clearly, that is, using words that are so descriptive, so referential only to that person, and not to anybody else, only to that person, and see what you have to do to talk this way, and get a feeling of how different that is from the way we usually talk. And I think this is one of the basic mechanisms which accounts for what we call inconsiderateness, lack of understanding of other people, is that we usually talk about other people in such a way that we don't individuate them. We talk about freshmen, we talk about women drivers, we talk about large categories of people. And so long as we do this, and so long as all day long we think in these terms, we find it really very difficult to get to know any particular person. We know, so far as we know, and it isn't too far, we know categories or general types of people, but there are no categories in nature. They're only in our heads, in our language forms. In nature, they're only individuals. It's you, me, you, today, at this hour, in these circumstances. We don't usually talk about that. And when we do, it makes a difference. We feel differently. We find ourselves in a different kind of relationship with others. Now, I want to go back to the object level, the macroscopic, M-A-C-R-O, the macroscopic level, object level, the level on which we observe or abstract with the naked eye and ear, so on. It's interesting to consider what an apple is on this level. Try to say all you can about an apple. Or take a pencil like this one that I'm going to hold up in front of you. Here's a pencil. Is it not? Tell me all about this pencil. Tell me all about it. Well, what could you say? Can you tell me all about it? All you can do is to put into words of some sort, as best you can, how this pencil looks to you, or feels if I give it to you to hold, or possibly smells. Doesn't have much smell as far as I know. I can't tell what it does. So it's from the standpoint of my olfactory sense, it doesn't exist. There's nothing there. See? It's as though I were blind. I probably am in my nose. I don't think I have a very good sense of smell. But how would I know this? How would I ever find it out? People tell me they smell things and I can't. But this is a rather vague way to find out something, isn't it? I don't know what they smell. How could I know? I can't smell it, so all I can possibly know about what they smell is their words as I hear them and interpret them. It's pretty hard to interpret something just on a verbal level. And I can't smell what they're talking about. So I'm in the position of a person who's deaf or blind, and someone is trying to tell him about a thunder storm or a lightning storm. It's impossible. Oh, you can tell him something, but he can't possibly know what you mean. Well, tell me all about the pencil. Try now. We can't do this, really, but try to yourselves as you sit there. Tell me all about this pencil. Well, you'll use some words that refer to sensations which you have regarding light and color. You'll probably use the word gray, or will you? Maybe you won't. Maybe to you that pencil looks blue. Or green, even. I don't know. To me, it looks kind of gray. But I don't know how it could look to you, because the color is not in the pencil. It's behind your eyes and my eyes. So you're going to have a hard time telling me all about the pencil. You can't do it. It's impossible, of course. Now, you can tell me some more. I've pulled the pencil apart, see? Took off the top. Now you can tell me some more. See, it's got an eraser. There's a steel barrel in it. And if you turn this about, you can talk about the hole in it, and so forth. Now if I could take off some more of it, you can tell me some more. See? Well, you get the point, don't you? If I keep taking the pencil apart, you can tell me more and more and more. But there'll come a time when I've done all I can with this, and you have seen all your eyes can react to, no matter how much I take the pencil apart. I can grind it up finally into a powder and put it under a high-powered microscope. And you can tell me some more about it. Now we go to the microscopic level, you see. Now, I don't mean the word microscopic here to be literally defined as microscopic. Telescopic is another word we can use. We're referring here to a general principle, and that is that you can observe or abstract on two general levels here. You can abstract or observe with the naked eye, or you can aid the eye in various ways by magnification, by extraneural means, as we call them technically. Extraneural, meaning something beyond the sensory receptors as they ordinarily work, something beyond the nervous system as it would ordinarily work. We aid it. We have extraneural means or aids, such as the lenses that we use to make microscopes or telescopes, or magnifying glasses of ordinary kinds, opera glasses of ordinary kinds, or the glasses that you wear on your nose. Those are extraneural means. Take them off and you see a difference, don't you? Put them on and you can see better, we say. These are extraneural means. And the moment you put on your glasses, you have gone to the microscopic level of abstracting. If you wear a hearing aid, you're operating on the microscopic level of abstracting. You're aided. Your auditory apparatus is aided by the hearing aid. So now you hear more. You hear better. You can abstract more details from the world of sound or the world of airwaves, air vibrations. And there are various other kinds of extraneural means. Any sort of chemical analysis which enables us to add something to something else and change the color of it, or possibly produce a vapor, or in some other way make something apparent, observable, abstractable, that was not before we did this. Any such thing is an extraneural means. So it's on this level of abstracting, then, that we operate when we abstract on the level which I have called in the diagram the microscopic level. And for the benefit of the radio listeners, this lies below the round circle, which we use to demonstrate or to represent the object level, the naked eye level. We make that a round circle to indicate something, and that is that it is a limited kind of abstracting. There is a boundary to that, a hard boundary. You can see only so much. You can hear only so much, and that's all. And so we make that a closed circle to represent that fact. You're limited very definitely by the capacity of your eyes and ears and so on to respond. Are you hot in here? Do you want to adjust that thing up there, thermostat? Get a different feedback here. Okay. Okay, thank you very much. I hope that cools off in time for us to benefit from it. Now, the next level down on the diagram, please remember, we're using the words down and up here in a purely metaphorical sense. We're not talking about altitudes, but down on the blackboard. We're talking about altitudes only with reference to the blackboard. The next level down on the blackboard, we don't make that a closed circle. We make that a spiral sort of a line to indicate that there is not a hard and fast limit to what you can observe or abstract on this level. It depends upon the quality of your apparatus. See, you'll hear more with one hearing aid than another, for example, or you will see more with one set of lenses than another. And So we want to represent this possibility by the way we draw the diagram. So if we make this a spiral to indicate that it's really open-ended, dissolves the possibility for developing a more powerful microscope or for developing a better hearing aid or whatnot, for making a kind of test for analyzing the blood that is a little more sensitive, so on. Well, now then, let's consider this a moment. I'll give you a microscope now. I'll grind up my pencil into the finest powder I can. I'll find the most highly developed mill there is anywhere. Get the very finest powder from this pencil. We're going to find out all we can about this pencil. We're just going to reduce it to the tiniest bits and examine each one of them under a microscope. And then we'll get the best microscope we can. Now tell me all about the pencil. Can you? You see, what you can still tell me is only what you can see with now, of course, the extra neural means and with the technical means involved in grinding the pencil to reduce it to a smaller size. Well, incidentally, when you do this, you're going to be startled out of your wits if you're not prepared for what you see. You're going to be looking down that tube, these little tiny particles that we have made by grinding the pencil as fine as we can to a very fine powder. Put some of these under the microscope in a little drop of water, you know, on a slide like you do in the zoology class or wherever you've used a microscope. And now we look at it. Lo and behold, what do we see? These little things are moving, are jiggling and jiggling and jiggling. Just, oh, it's a jazz. It's a jazz. They're just lively as they can be. What is going on here? What is it? How do you account for this? How do you account for this? This goes on every time you see sufficiently fine particles suspended in any kind of a liquid. Anytime you see it. It's been found, as I think I say in this book, People in Quandaries, it's been found inside a quartz crystal, apparently millions of years old. These little particles suspended in the liquid inside the crystal have been jiggling like that apparently for millions of years. What goes on? How do you account for this? Imagine the first man to see this and how he must have been utterly flabbergasted. It was first seen by Brown, the Scottish botanist. We call it the Brownian movement. And I imagine he had quite a hard time telling Mrs. Brown that evening what he'd seen. She probably looked at him a little peculiarly and may have had a sleepless night wondering what was the matter with Mr. Brown. This is impossible. Little particles of matter could go dancing along for millions of years, or they would dance at all, just in a drop of water. You know, what we call these days the electronic theory, or the molecular theory of matter, was developed to account for the Brownian movement. No wonder Mrs. Brown was puzzled. She had no molecular theory. Of course, she just had a husband who came home and told her ridiculous things that he had seen in a tube. But you can see them. Everybody sees them who looks in the right place. What do you do with this? Well, I'll tell you what we do with this. Oppenheimer, the physicist, summed it up very beautifully. He said, what we don't understand, we explain to each other. See? What we don't understand, we explain to each other. We don't understand the Brownian movement, of course. We don't. Using the word understand as you would in your common sense everyday way. You don't understand the Brownian movement, so you have to explain it You have to have it explained. You have to work out all together. We have to work out some kind of explanation, or we'll be most uneasy, uncomfortable. We can't stand to be in the presence of something we don't understand. This is as much a part of being a human being as it is to need to fly if you're a bird, or to need to burrow if you're a worm. That you've got to understand. You'll simply die if you don't. So we have to have explanations. This is biological, as far as I know. This is as much a part of us as the hunger drive or the reproduction drive or any other drive we have, the thirst drive. We have an understanding drive. We've got to understand. Now, we don't always understand very well, but so long as we think we do, we feel better. How would you try to explain the Brownian movement if you came upon it for the first time? Never heard of it before? And if you can, imagine that you were Mr. Brown, the Scottish botanist. And nobody had ever talked about things like this. Well, let's think about this a little bit. You see, this indicates the need we have for another level on the diagram. After we have seen all we can through the most high-powered microscopes we can devise, of the finest particles we can find, see, we're trying to tell ourselves all about my pencil here I'm holding in my hand. So we imagine now we have ground it up into the finest part. We can't grind it any finer. There are no mills. This is as far as we've gone, 1956. Now, maybe by 1957 we'll have a mill that will grind it a little finer. But as of today, we've done the best we can. And we've used the most powerful microscope we can. And we know, don't we, that we can't say all about the pencil. We realize, as we indicate by leaving that spiral open-ended, that this probably isn't all. We could see. We had more apparatus. And besides, we see things that can't be understood unless there's something else. There's got to be something more than meets the eye. Or else, what meets the eye is utterly incomprehensible. Nobody can possibly understand the Brownian movement without imagining what else there must be there. Now, it's what we imagine that must also be there that we represent on the bottom level of the diagram, which we call the submicroscopic, sub meaning below, beyond, the submicroscopic level of abstraction. So, we make that appear, I'm talking now to the radio listeners, we make that the same sort of a general shape as a spiral, but we make it out of a dotted line. There's dots. And if you want to make it a little bigger, if you want somehow, if you're ingenious and can imagine how to diagram that, to represent that it is, so far as we know, simply without limit. We don't know, there are, as far as we know, no limits to imagination. We can imagine ever so many different sorts of things and goings-on to account for what we see. Under the most high-powered microscope we can devise, using the finest particles we can contrive to make. Now we can imagine we can't imagine any possible limits to imagination. So make the diagram accordingly. Leave it open-ended, make it out of dots, make it out of anything that will suggest to you that as of today we have achieved what imagination we have achieved to explain to each other what we don't understand. But this is pioneer territory. We will never close this frontier. This you can look forward to all your life with excitement. There is always a possibility for developing something different from the current kinds of what we call theories. Einstein will be outdated. He probably is now, for all I know. There's no limit to this. Now we need to recognize that on this level, of submicroscopic goings-on. We're talking about, according to our intentions, we mean to talk about something real. This is matter. This is reality. Yes, it's what we imagine must be there, but it must be there. Now, what sort of thing is this? What kind of language can we use for talking about it? Well, we can use various kinds of language. There's no end to the imagination. And this is the language you find on the very highest verbal levels of abstract. And that's why we join the highest verbal levels with the submicroscopic level by means of the line that has an arrow in it. The arrow pointing down from the highest verbal levels to the submicroscopic level to indicate that with the language that we have contrived on these highest verbal abstract levels, we now talk about what we imagine must be beyond the microscope, what must be beyond the Brownian movement, or any other phenomena that we can see, whether the Brownian movement or anything else. Now, what kinds of language, then, do we find on these very highest abstract levels? Well, let's talk about a very common example of something. I think I've done this in the book Your Most Enchanted Listener, but let's do it here. Let's try to explain to each other what we don't understand in the situation in which we have put a glass of water on a table, on a windowsill or somewhere. We put it there, we'll say, last Friday, a week ago. And the glass of water was full at that time. Well, now it's down, depending on a lot of things, perhaps. It'll be down a ways, more or less, but it'll be down. Let's say now the glass is half full. How do you account for this? This is what you can see with the naked eye. You can see that the water has gone down in the glass since you last looked at it last Friday. Now you don't understand this. How do you explain it? Well, in general, men have imagined two sets of possible circumstances to account for this sort of thing, for evaporation, what we call evaporation. Nothing is more common than evaporation. We all know about evaporation. But you don't understand it, do you? Do you? I'll tell you one way that I was told when I was a small boy by my mother. This is how new the world is, or how old our ideas are, or something. She told me that when she was a little girl in Sweden, they would put out milk by the lake at certain times for the brownies. They really did. They put out milk for the brownies. And then they would go back the next morning, and the milk would be gone. And of course, the brownies had come and drank it. That's one kind of explanation. The brownies drank it. What's the matter with that? Is there anything especially wrong with that explanation? What is wrong with it? I love the story that I repeated in People in Quandaries about the Ploglids. You remember that? Pencils, and two mysteries. Anybody wanted to find a pencil, he couldn't find one. And then he did somehow find one and went to the sharpener, sharpened it. The sharpener was always full of shavings. How to account for these mysteries? And the emperor appointed the committee. And the wise philosophers who worked so long and so hard and finally came up with a wonderful theory that accounted for both mysteries. There were little people down under the earth called Ploglids, and they come at night when you aren't there, and they find all the pencils. And they take them to the pencil sharpener, and they grind them all up. And then they go back into the earth. Counts for both mysteries. The only trouble is there aren't any Plugleys. Well, how do you know there aren't any Plugleys? Well, now we can get back to the evaporation. Here's the water glass. It's like that, you see. Maybe the brownies drank it. Maybe the Plogleys came and drank it. Or the Gilligs. The Gilligs may have done it. There's another theory. Of course, it's fantastic. It's just fantastic. But it's to this effect that that water is actually made up of little tiny bits. You know, this stuff that runs and pours and gets you wet. That's really made up of little particles. Well, oh, they're awfully tiny, of course. You can't possibly ever see them. This is a very, very important part of this theory. You can't ever see them. Now, if you overlook this, you're going to misunderstand quite completely. You'll never see them. They're that tiny. Now then, you've imagined these little tiny particles. Now there's no end to what you can imagine about them. Well, for instance, they're electrically charged. Imagine that. That doesn't sound like, well, after all we're imagining, it's gone. They're electrically charged. And they move around. They're restless as they can be. Ooh, they just zip. Zip, 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 zip. Just all of them zipping all at once. And of course, some of them go so fast that they go right on out of the glass. But most of them don't, because they have these electrical charges and they sort of attract each other. So while they go very fast, they kind of go in toward each other most times. It's only when they get off toward the edge of the circuit and they're going so fast that they zip right out of the glass. And this happens often enough that since last Friday, half the little pieces of water got out. Can you believe that? Can you possibly believe that? That's the molecular theory of matter. That's how we explain to each other what we don't understand about evaporation. In general, there are these two kinds of theories. Plogleys and brownies and gremlins and all kinds of little people. You remember, and then these more impersonal kinds of theories about little pieces of things. or wave motions, you know. You want to read something that really is, it's, you talk about Gertrude's Dime being difficult to read, or E.E. Cummins. Well, you read some of the articles in the technical physical journals about the controversy regarding whether there are little particles, whether matter is made up of little particles, or of some kind of just wave motion. And you'll think Gertrude Stein is talking the clearest English you've ever read. Maybe, unless you have studied enough physics, then it can be very clear, of course. And that means if you have studied enough of this kind of language, you get after a while so you can talk it. And you ought to go sometime to some place like the Bureau of Standards. I went last summer to one of the stations of the Bureau of Standards and took the tour. And some young PhD was trying to tell us about some waves that he was studying that come from outer space. And all I did was to ask a few very simple questions that I think any second grader would have asked if he'd been alert. And the poor fellow was just stumped. He'd been talking this language so long that he didn't really know what he was talking about, except the words he was using. And all I was asking is, well, what are the operations you perform? what is it you observe? What's the apparatus? What does it do? Where is it? What is the record you get? Well, he got a jiggly line on something, along a strip of paper. And I was just asking, well, what do the jiggly lines mean? He hadn't talked about jiggly lines for months. He had been talking about waves, various kinds, and other things that I can't remember. But you see, if you talk this language long enough, it comes as easy to you as Chinese or French. It's about as hard to translate back into English. Now, we have then these two kinds of theories. You remember the little story I just got about time to remind you? I think it's perhaps helpful to be reminded of some of these things that you may have read rather fast. And perhaps with a certain air of wondering what the point was. Remember the story about Einstein's man who is trying to understand what goes on inside the watch, but he can't open the case? This is like a man trying to understand nature, you know. Think of yourself trying to understand what you mean by a person. You're like Einstein's man who's trying to understand the watch, and he can't open the case. He can see the hands moving. He can hear the ticking. And as Einstein says, if he is sufficiently ingenious, he may be able to make a picture inside his head of what there might be inside the watch that makes the hands move and that makes the ticking. But he will never know, and it would never even occur to him to think that it would be meaningful to ask what there is really inside the watch. This is the part of that story that you may have missed. It will never occur to him that anyone could ever know what there might be inside the watch. You'll never know. You'll never know whether there really are gillies. You'll never know whether there really are electrons. And it doesn't matter. And this is terribly difficult to understand. Because we have been, ever since we were babies, we have been taught that there is somewhere a truth that you can discover. And now from all this we learn there isn't. But there is no end to what you can imagine the truth might be. But you will never know whether there really are gillies. But after you understand this well enough, you won't really want to know anymore. It won't make any difference to you. It won't mean anything to you. You really will think it sort of quaint that anyone would wonder. And so it doesn't bother you. Not at all. In fact, it's much more exciting the other way. Because now you see there is no limit to what you can imagine. There are no frontiers here that will ever be closed. Always expanding. And that's, of course, basically the reason why. Since this has come to be realized by a few people, we have had such tremendous development in all those fields that are affected by the work that is done by these imaginative persons whom we call nuclear physicists and so forth. We live with their imaginings. I'll see you Monday.
This has been a lecture in the classroom series General Semantics. The speaker was Wendell Johnson, professor of speech pathology and psychology at the State University of Iowa. A reading list and an outline for this course may be obtained by writing to Professor Wendell Johnson, radio station WSUI in Iowa City. This classroom broadcast is heard each Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 8:30 over WSUI in Iowa City.